It's a long way from Brantford, Ontario, to the air chair on Coast to Coast AM, but here we are, 17 floors above the vibrant Dundas Square here in Toronto. If you've not been to Toronto, think of a slightly less grandiose Times Square. That's basically the best picture I can paint for you. That's where we are for the duration tonight. And my name is Richard Serrett. And outside Toronto, you have not likely heard this voice. And it's a real thrill. I told George Norrie last night it was like getting a call up from the Yankees after riding the buses in Columbus. And all of a sudden last night, there I was on the phone speaking with the Mick. And what would that make me? I don't know. They used to say I had good glove and no bat. So maybe I'm Tony Kubek. Welcome, and we've got a great show for you tonight. Of course, it is Friday night, and that means 3 hours of open lines, beginning in an hour. And before we get to that, you're going to hear probably the most amazing aviation mystery you've never heard. Possibly even more bizarre than the disappearance of Amelia Earhart. Stranger than many of the disappearances over the Bermuda Triangle, and we're going to reach out to a suburb in Moscow tonight and speak with a gentleman there, an American now living in Moscow, who will tell us about the ongoing odyssey of King Bird 50. First, the headlines, quite frankly, are dire. Possible swine flu outbreak at New York School Prep School. Most fatal flu victims aged between 25 and 45. Swine flu could infect trade and travel. Schwarzenegger has rigorous plan. World Health Organization ready with antivirals. The CDC says it's too late to contain. 60 dead. Mexico City launches a huge vaccination campaign. Close to 1,000 suspected cases. Of course, we're talking about this mysterious flu outbreak. Yesterday, of course, news broke that the CDC was tracking several cases of swine flu in the U.S., with 5 cases in San Diego, 2 in San Antonio, Texas. It turns out the CDC was looking into these cases because of a serious outbreak of swine flu in Mexico that has killed over 60 people and infected over 1,000. The World Health Organization says the strain is of high concern. The influenza virus is infecting and killing primarily young healthy people. Henry L. Nyman earned a PhD at the University of Southern California in 1978. His dissertation focused on feline retroviral expression in tumors in domestic cats. He is the founder and president of Recombinomics, and tonight he is our expert flu tracker. Henry, welcome to Coast to Coast AM.
Well, thank you, Richard. It's good to be here.
Is this possibly the pandemic we've been hearing about?
Well, there's a couple different pandemics that you've been hearing about, one of which is H5N1, and this is not H5N1, but the other would be a pandemic similar to the one in 1918, and this has a lot of similarities with that one. So, yes, it could very well be a major pandemic.
Similarities between this H1N1 and the Spanish flu of 1918. Explain what those similarities are, Henry.
Well, they're both H1N1, and they both involve swine. And the 1918 was commonly referred to as the big one. Between 20 and 50 million people died, and there were so many people that died that probably ended World War One because so many soldiers were dying. And that did affect primarily young adults, and that was partially due to the fact that the virus elicited a strong immune response, and the people with the strongest immune responses ended up dying because they ended up attacking their own tissues. And so that's been one of the concerns, is that that type of pandemic could reoccur. There have been two other ones last century in 57 and 68. Those were much milder. And there's been a lot of attention focused on H5N1, and H5N1 is certainly still around. But this one is swine, and it's H1N1. And it really came to surface on Wednesday. The CDC issued a dispatch from their MMWR, it's a Morbidity and Mortality Weekly Report. And as his name sounds, it's normally done on Friday, and this came out on Wednesday. So dispatches don't come out, you know, that often. And that was with the first two cases that were in Southern California. And they were described as being swine flu victims. And that wasn't that unusual, because there's usually a few each year that are described. But the fact that there were two in the same report was unusual. But what made it more unusual was the fact that they weren't related to each other, and they weren't in contact with swine. Most of the people that get swine flu get it from swine. And that is one indication that it's human-to-human transmission. But then the other indication was that they had family members that had symptoms. They were mild and hadn't been tested, but each one had a family member that was sick before they were, and a family member after. So that all pointed to human-to-human with two cases that were 150 miles apart. And that set off the alarm bells. And then the CDC came out the next day. There were five more. And again, they were all in little clusters. And so that indicated that it was transmitting human to human efficiently. And that sets it apart from most of the swine flu in the past. Usually when people get swine flu, they have a fairly mild disease, and it really doesn't go beyond that individual person. And in this case, it was clustering, and it was going human to human. And then there were the reports from Mexico. At that time, it really wasn't clear what was going on in Mexico. There were these reports of atypical pneumonias with previously healthy young adults between the ages of 25 and 44.
And let me ask you, why does it strike the young and healthy? Normally, when we think of influenza taking a toll, it's usually in nursing homes on the elderly or those that are already compromised in some way. Why does this particular influenza attack and kill young, healthy adults?
Well, that's what happened in 1918. It was, as I called it, an inverted curve. So instead of the very young and very old, it was really the young adults that were dying. That's because they've got a healthy immune system, and the virus is able to spread, and then they mount an immune response. It's sometimes referred to as a cytokine storm, and they have all this immune cytokines that attack the virus. And the virus spreads so quickly that that attack really not only attacks the virus, but attacks the patient's healthy tissues. And the immune response really kills the patient rather than the virus.
Henry Nyman is with us, founder of Recombinomics, and we're linked up to his blog on the coasttocoastam.com website. Henry, we don't want anyone to panic, but when we read a headline that says that the CDC is saying it's too late to contain, what do you make of that?
Well, this has a lot of parallels with 1918. And 1918 was really two waves. The first wave was a mild wave, and the second wave was a much more severe wave. The mild wave really put the virus into the human population and spread it, and people were not that sick. And that's essentially what's happened here. There have been no deaths in the United States, and these cases really began almost a month ago. The first two cases really developed symptoms on March 28th and March 30th, and they weren't even the first one of their family. So it ends up spreading, and it's kind of a silent spread because, number one, it's influenza A, so people either aren't sick enough to go to the doctor, or they go to the doctor and they test. And they tested their influenza A, and they think they have just normal seasonal flu, and they treat it accordingly, and the symptoms are essentially the same. It's only if they subtype it further to see if it's an H1N1, then they find out that it doesn't type as H1N1 because the typing is done for human H1N1, and this is swine H1N1. There's enough differences that the test doesn't work, and then you have to do a more sophisticated test.
Henry, if the first wave is somewhat more mild, then I guess that would be somewhat desirous to if you're going to catch it early, and then you build up, I suppose, some sort of an antibody to the more serious second and third waves.
Right, and that's the essentially what happens, except the problem is that the virus basically changes enough to come around the second time. So the first time people don't get that sick, they develop some immunity. But then when the virus, which is a swine virus, is in the human population, it interacts with human viruses, flu viruses, and it exchanges genetic information. And so it ends up becoming more human-like, and it's got enough differences that it can, again, attack a significant portion of the population, but it's more virulent the second time around. But you're right. You're probably better off having the mild version than having nothing. But the mild version, just like seasonal flu, it can help, but people get the flu year after year because the virus is very adaptable and essentially has to adapt to survive. If everybody had immunity, the flu virus would disappear because it wouldn't have any hosts.
Well, flu shots obviously are controversial in many quarters, but would a flu shot do any good for the second wave if it's going to mutate anyway?
Well, if you're talking about a seasonal flu shot, that probably isn't going to do much good either way. The swine flu H1N1 is different enough from the human H1N1 that the seasonal flu won't protect a whole lot. There is an effort to actually make a vaccine, and it's already started, against the swine flu. And so the hope is that even though it changes, it won't change enough to kill you, that essentially if you do get infected, you'll have a milder infection, or you'll have enough antibody, and they'll cross-react enough to prevent you from getting infected the second time.
Henry, very quickly, leave us with some precautions that we can take to prevent getting this.
Well, what they're doing in Mexico is they're basically shutting down the schools in there. And they're telling people not to go to large gatherings. And essentially, if it's in the area, that's one of the things you can do is to have some avoidance of crowds and large gatherings. Other than that, it is still sensitive to Tamiflu. So there is an antiviral that does work. Using it prophylactically is difficult because it only works while you're taking it. And a dose only works for 10 days, so timing that would be very difficult. Having Tamiflu to treat at the first signs would be one way to actually treat it. But it's mostly kind of avoiding crowds if it's in the area, and of course washing hands and good hygiene.
All right,
helps.
Henry, we appreciate your time tonight.
Okay, Richard, it was good being with you.
Henry Nyman is the founder and president of Recombinomics, and tonight tracking the H1N1 for us here on Coast to Coast. When we come back, on the night of 22nd December 2001, something very strange happened at Thule Air Force Base in Greenland, and we are about to find out what that was when we're joined live from Moscow, author-writer James Corin. You're listening to Coast AM. I'm Richard Serrett. Richard Serrett with you here on Coast to Coast AM, live from Toronto, high above Dundas Square. And imagine an aircraft departing the United States in 1948 and arriving to its destination on schedule, plus or minus, about 52 years. This incredible tale, the ongoing journey of Kingbird 50, first came to my attention a few years ago. And we're about to speak with a gentleman living in Moscow. He is a retired executive with the Eastman Kodak Company and now a journalist, writer, living in Mamontovka. And James Corin is also the author of Footprints in the Snow, Tales of Haunted Russia. James, welcome once again. Good to speak with you, Coast to Coast AM. How are you?
I'm just fine, Richard. It's good to speak to you.
Well,
I've been looking forward to this.
As have I. This is I get more emails about this story, I think, than any other I've ever heard or I've ever talked about, and that is because it is such a remarkable tale. And this, we should point out, comes to you from an unnamed colonel with a number of years under his belt. This is a veteran
Who is still serving.
He is still serving. All right, Lo. So let's dial back to the 22nd of December, 2001, and we're at Thule Air Force Base in Greenland. What happened?
Okay, we need to go back a little farther than that. We need to go back about 22 hours farther than that. In 1947, the only aircraft in the United States arsenal that was capable of long-duration flights were the B-36, which was a huge aircraft. It was the big six-engined one with four jet engines to assist. I think you know which one I'm talking about.
Right, like a Super Fortress.
And the B-50. The B-50 was a highly modified B-29. It was bigger than the B-29, but it was essentially the same configuration. They were all assigned to the 509th Air Group because they were the only aircraft capable of carrying nuclear weapons.
That would put them at Roswell, would it not?
That's right. The home base for this aircraft was Roswell, New Mexico. It was not stationed at Roswell, but that was their home base.
Right.
This particular aircraft was stationed with a squadron at McGuire Air Force Base, New Jersey. On the night of December 21st, that aircraft left McGuire Air Force Base, New Jersey, bound for Germany. It was part of the Berlin airlift, which was going on at the time. Now, I'm saying this because there was some confusion in the initial story about the aircraft's designation. King Bird 50 indicates that it was a KB-50. A KB-50 was not online in 1947. It was a much later aircraft. King Bird is not the designation of a type of aircraft. It was a call sign for that particular aircraft.
All right, but it's essentially a B-50 bomber.
It's a B-50A, okay?
A B-50A, gotcha.
The first version of the B-50, okay? It was escorting a group of B-29s, which they had a far more sophisticated aircraft escorting less sophisticated aircraft. You understand?
Gotcha.
So King Bird is their leader. That aircraft left McGuire Air Force Base, New Jersey, made a brief stop at Gander, which was normal flight plan. They would then proceed to Thule, which is the normal flight plan. Make a brief stop at Thule and then go on to Germany. The B-50 itself could have made the flight directly to Germany, but since it was escorting the other aircraft and they didn't have that much range, it had to be done in hops.
Right. And Thule at that time was not called Thule, but that's...
It was not called Thule. It was called Blue One.
And it was under U.S. Air Force control, was it?
It was under U.S. Air Force control.
All right.
But it was called Blue One or something like that. But the jargon for it was always Thule, okay? It was always identified between pilots as Thule.
Okay.
It later became Thule Air Force Base, but at that time it was Blue One, located near Thule.
Okay, so King Bird 50 is headed towards Thule Air Force Base.
It's headed toward Thule Air Force Base. Its cruising speed is about 300 miles an hour. It's not a very fast aircraft, and it cannot go very high compared to what a modern aircraft can do. Several hours out of Thule, they encountered a very severe storm. The B-29s apparently went down low, diverted, and got out of it. The B-50 could not do this because of its configuration. It couldn't drop down quite that low. But it also can't get high enough to get over the storm. So they're having to fight their way through it.
This is North Atlantic, December. I'm guessing it's just getting battered by some pretty fierce headwinds.
It was considered to be one of the worst Atlantic storms in history.
All right, stay put, James. We'll pick this up on the other side. The ongoing odyssey of King Bird 50. James Korn is in Russia. I'm Richard Serrett. You're listening to Coast AM. And a great pleasure to sit in for George Norrie here tonight from Toronto. And we'll get back to this mysterious flight of the Kingbird 50 on the other side. Don't go away. Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast. Richard Serrett sitting in for George Norrie and James Korn on the line from a suburb near Moscow. And James relating this amazing aviation mystery. So we should be clear, James, we are talking about essentially the flight plan here back in December of 1948. A crew of 11 aboard this B-50A bomber en route from McGuire Air Force Base to Germany, but first a stop off at Thule Air Force Base. But they encounter some pretty heavy headwinds and are lost over the North Atlantic.
Essentially what happened was about 3 hours out of Thule, the aircraft just went off the radar, with everyone assuming that it had gone down. And that's the way it was recorded. There was never anything found, never any trace of it. It just went off the radar like a downed aircraft. And it was immediately more or less forgotten. And it stayed that way until the night of the 22nd of December 2001.
Exactly 53 years later.
Exactly 53 years later. Thule picked up an incoming aircraft on their radar, flying what they considered to be an extremely low altitude for a relatively large aircraft. It was also going very slow, much slower than an aircraft that size would be going in 2001.
Was there any radio contact?
There was no radio contact at first. They tried to make radio contact, but there was no response. The aircraft continued to come in. Finally, the radio operator somehow got onto a sideband of one of the very old and now unused frequencies that had been a standard frequency in 1947. When they got on that, they began to pick up a call signal and a positioning signal. Now, in the days before radar was extremely accurate, an aircraft, when they were approaching a base, at fixed intervals, they would send their identification and their position and speed. Just a very short transmission to let the field know that they were incoming.
Sure. Essentially, they thought they were scheduled to arrive on time.
To arrive on time, and they were on time. They were exactly on time. The aircraft appeared at exactly the same time, clockwise, that it disappeared, at exactly the same position. So the first report Thule got on this unused sideband was, Kingbird 50, Thule, this is Kingbird 50. We are however many nautical miles out. Our airspeed is, I don't remember exactly what the airspeed was. We, you know, our ETA is, and then they stop transmitting, which is the procedure.
Now, James, let me just remind listeners, James Korn on the line from Moscow, recounting an incredible, mysterious flight of Kingbird 50. We should point out that Thule Air Force Base, because it's in Greenland, and this time of the year, I'm imagining that the tower crew there would be probably used to receiving unscheduled flights, planes in distress, etc.
Very rarely. There was no aircraft scheduled to come in.
No, but it wouldn't be unusual for an unscheduled flight.
It wouldn't be unusual for an unscheduled flight, but it was rare.
Right.
Anything that would come in like that would be a disabled aircraft. It would be someone trying to make an emergency landing.
Okay.
And that's what they assumed. They also assumed this from the altitude and speed, that the aircraft was disabled since it was going so slowly and it was so low. So they prepare a crash crew on the runway. They also don't understand why this aircraft doesn't have a transponder.
And why it's using this harmonic of a long obsolete Air Force frequency.
Frequency. But, once again, this could they're assuming a disabled aircraft.
And this is being related to you again, just to remind listeners, related to you by a U.S. Air Force colonel in the Thule Tower.
Who was in the Thule Tower at the time.
He called you hours after this all
Several
happened.
Hours after it happened, he got off base and called me.
Okay. So radio transmission ceases.
About 15 minutes later, they're a little bit closer. They transmit again. Same thing. Kingbird 50, Thule Tower. We are however many nautical miles out our airspeed is, our ETA is. And they turn it off. This progresses at 15-minute intervals, just exactly by the book, the way it was supposed to be done in 1947. Exactly by protocol. The last transmission they got was just as the aircraft came over the lip of the glacier. At that point, they were about 15 minutes out from the airfield. At that point, the aircraft comes back on with its normal transmission, position, airspeed, etc. But at this point, they should have been able to see to the Air Force base. They couldn't see the base. So the command pilot of the aircraft, his exact words were, Thule, this is Kingbird. We should see you, but we can't see you. Light up the night.
Turn on the airstrip lights.
Turn on everything.
Yes.
And when Thule gets the words light up the night, they turn on everything. You can literally see Thule in a storm a couple of hundred miles out. They're capable of lighting things up.
Let me just stop you there, James, before we continue along with this amazing tale. The colonel that's relating to this to you over the phone, how did you come to know him?
I've known him all my life.
Okay.
And we went to school together.
And what? How did he sound as he's relating to this story? Was he frightened? Was he panicked? Was he confused?
He was confused, I think is the word you could use. He wasn't panicked. He didn't understand what was going on.
And we'll see as the story progresses exactly why he was so confused. But let's just to move things along a little bit, because time is always tight. So they lose radio transmission, and at that point, I'm guessing the Thule Tower dispatches a search party.
They lost radio contact right after that broadcast, and the plane went off the radar again. All right, now they're assuming that the aircraft is down. But since it's over the glacier, they know that it's down somewhere over the glacier. And they know the flight pattern is headed for the base. So as soon as they could get one mobilized, they sent out a search party. Now, remember, this is Greenland in December, and it is as dark as the inside of a bucket of coal. There is no sunlight in Greenland in December. It's perpetually dark. So it took them a little while to get out and find this aircraft. But they did find it. They had brought it in for a pretty good belly landing. They did a wheels-up belly landing on the glacier with a couple of meters of snow under it. There was very little damage. A couple of bent prop blades and some abrasion. And
the crew?
And the crew was dead.
All 11.
All 11. But now here, this is the other place where they start getting suspicious about this thing. The aircraft, no one had ever seen this aircraft before. You know, we're talking about people that hadn't even been born when this aircraft was built. For the most part, the B-50 went out of service completely in 1959. This is a first-run aircraft. It was built in 1946 and 47. Most of the personnel on Thule weren't even born then. So they're looking at an aircraft they've never seen before, but it's got U.S. Air Force markings on it. They're also looking at a very large propeller-driven airplane, and they know that there is no such thing in inventory now. Not with reciprocal engines.
Add that again to the obsolete Air Force frequency that they were using, and my gosh, these poor Air Force personnel at Thule must have just been up a tree.
They're looking at something that absolutely shouldn't exist. It's an anachronism. When they got inside the aircraft, absolutely intact. Everything was in perfect order. The crew was still in their positions, and they were dead. But they were not frozen. They were still, obviously they had only been dead for a little while.
So because it was not a terribly violent landing, I'm guessing then that the cause of death was hypothermia.
Hypothermia. They knew that they were close to the airbase, apparently, but with the weather conditions that were prevalent at the time, they didn't have the cold weather gear to try and hike. So they figured, stay with the aircraft, and they'll eventually send somebody out to get us.
Were they wearing...
Because they assumed, of course, that they were expected.
Sure. Were they wearing vintage 1940s uniforms?
Everything was exactly the way it should have been for 1947.
What about a log? Was there a log on board?
There was a log on board. There was a navigator's log on board. Everything was completely up to date. And this is where it gets really strange.
Like it hasn't been up until now, James.
this documents the strangeness. The logs on board indicate a flight from McGuire to Gander to Thule. The log entries are exactly the way they should be at exactly the proper intervals, covering a 22-hour flight that began on the night of December 21st, 1947, and ended on the night of December 22nd, 1947. Listen carefully. December 22nd, 1947 is the last entry.
Huh.
At exactly the time the aircraft went down on the glacier at Thule.
In 2001.
In 2001.
Yes, I think we need to reinforce that point. They left McGuire in 19...
They left
McGuire in 47, and they arrived in 2001.
But according to their log, it was still 1947. And everything was exactly entered in order.
So what did they do with the bodies of the crewmen? Did they...
That's a good question. The aircraft, they set out a recovery of, you know, one of those split flatbed things in a hoist and brought the aircraft back to the base, at which time they took the bodies off the airplane. They were taken to the base hospital and then onward to the base morgue, and that's the last time anybody ever saw them.
Did your colonel friend see them? Was he part of the search party?
No.
Okay. Did he see Did he see the bodies in the morgue?
He did see the bodies.
These were young servicemen, I'm guessing,
young
then?
Young servicemen. The oldest one was in his 30s. The command pilot was in his mid-30s, apparently.
Did they have dog tags?
All of them.
Do we know who they are?
He did not see them, and it was not released. But, yes, they were wearing dog tags. Yes, they did have an identification on them. But that was never released.
At what point, then, does your colonel get on the phone and call you, and why you?
Okay, they've got a major scramble going on naturally. With all this going on, they've got the base locked down. It was the next morning, very early in the morning, after they had everything secured, that he was able to get off base. Now, with a lockdown going on, he's not about to try and call anybody from the base. But this is unusual enough that he figured somebody needed to know. Well, I went to school with this guy. I've known him all my life. And he called me basically because he knew that I was a writer and that I was releasing to news services. And he was pretty sure that this was not going to be released.
Would he, do you suspect, been in some sort of danger had they known he was contacting you?
He'd still be in Leavenworth.
I can imagine, yeah.
That's why I'm not going to say anything further. He'd still be in Leavenworth.
And you know this gentleman well enough to say with 100% conviction that you believe his version of the story?
He doesn't have an imaginative bone in his body. There is.
What happened to the plane? What happened to the plane?
The aircraft was apparently gone over with a fine-tooth comb. They managed to get the thing put back together. There was very little damage. And here's where it gets a little bit stranger. Now, they can't keep this thing on Thule. There's interest in finding out what's going on, apparently, and, you know, how this happened. And it can't be done on Thule. They don't have the facilities. It has to be taken back to the States. Now, it would seem that the logical thing to do would be to take it apart, put it inside a C-141, which it would fit inside the C-41 easily, you know, once it was disassembled, and fly it back to the States. But they didn't do that. They got the thing back into flying condition, found an aircrew that could handle reciprocal engines, and they flew it back to the States.
Who flew it?
They found an aircrew that had flown C-97s, which is the transport version of this thing that stayed in service a lot longer than the bomber did.
So these would be older pilots, I'm guessing.
It's older pilots, but they found a couple of guys that could fly the thing.
Now, did these pilots know the circumstances behind why this plane ended up where it did?
No.
They were just flown to Greenland and said, here, fly this thing back.
They were flown to Greenland and told to fly this thing back.
And again, at this point, we've lost the trail on the 11 crewmen's bodies. We don't know what happened to them.
Absolutely no word on it, still.
And what about the log? The names would have been entered in the log, I'm guessing, of the crewmen. No?
No. Just flight data. Now, there are records of this aircraft, the one that went down over the ocean in 47. And I'm sure it's the same names. I've never looked.
In other words, the original flight from 1947 that went down over the North Atlantic, yes, they had to be registered. Those names have to be registered somewhere. People have families. Those families perhaps are still alive.
Some of the families would have to be still alive. But anyway, they flew this thing back. And, of course, the only way they could fly it back is the same way they flew it to begin with. It can't refuel in midair. It's not capable of that.
So it has to land in Gander?
So you take it back to Gander, then you go from Gander down to McGuire, and then from McGuire to wherever they're going to do the testing. Well, when this guy called me, and I can't even use his first name, they had already started getting the thing ready to fly back. Well, I got, and like I said, his assumption was that since they're flying it, it's got to go the same way. Now, I have a fairly extensive mailing and contact list.
Somebody must have seen this thing flying over.
So I got on my mailing and contact list and got a hold of something like 2,000 people that live up and down the eastern seaboard of the United States. Calculated how many hours it was going to take this airplane to get from Thule to Gander. You know, if it's flying at its normal cruising speed in good weather.
Right.
I gave them a time bracket and said, look, if any of you hear or see a very large piston-powered four-engine airplane coming over or hear one. And it's in, of course, you and I are about the same age. We know what a propeller-driven airplane sounds like. They're different.
Pretty loud, pretty hard to miss. Listen,
you can't miss it.
James, can you hold on?
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Okay, sit tight. We'll be back and continue along in this amazing voyage, the mysterious flight of Kingbird 50. Richard Serrett sitting in for George Norrie on Coast to Coast AM.